Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Tonight we have with us Dr. Edward Tick, and we're going to talk about his book, War and the Soul and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. How are you, Dr. Tick?
I'm well, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I have to tell you something. I read everybody's books that comes on my show, and this one was a hard one for me because my son went into the Army about 3 months ago, and some of the things that you wrote that happens in boot camp, this was hard for me to read, and how it affects these young men's minds. It's hard.
It is very hard, and I'm sorry that your family's going through the hardship, and also a general issue that you're bringing up already is that the public in general and families of our service people in particular don't know how difficult and demanding military services and the entire transformation that we put our young people through from civilian to soldier.
It was
so the challenges begin immediately and transformations begin, and boot camp is very rough.
Well, before we get started, why don't you tell everybody just a little bit about you so they know who you are and where to find you.
Thank you. My name is Ed Tick. Again, I have been working with veterans and other survivors of war and severe violence and trauma for almost 30 years. I began working as a psychotherapist with Vietnam veterans back in the late 1970s, even before post-traumatic stress disorder was recognized as a diagnosis. But even at the beginning of my work, it was quite clear how profoundly troubling and troubled the war environment is and the extensive damage it does to anybody caught in it.
Go ahead.
Well, I worked with veterans. I mean, I have for this entire 30 years, but one important point for our listeners in this show is that after about 8 years of the best, more or less traditional psychotherapy I could possibly offer, trying to help our veterans heal, I went through my own transformation and conducted a worldwide search in all of the warrior cultures and warrior traditions for looking for much more holistic, spiritually based, and comprehensive means for helping warriors come home, because ordinary psychotherapy doesn't go far enough. Our medical model of post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't encompass the profound degree of transformation and distress that war puts people through. And so from about the mid to late 1980s to the present, I've been working in other traditions with other cultural and spiritual teachings to help bring our veterans comfort and healing.
I think it's a lot more traumatic after reading your book than anybody could ever imagine.
Yes, that is so, unfortunately. War is always profoundly traumatic, and we have stories of what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder from ancient times. We have tales from the Egyptian hieroglyphics and from ancient Greece, from Homer and Herodotus and other sources, from the wars between the Romans and the Jewish wars around 70 AD, from other Roman sources, and from many, many other sources all over the world about what we call PTSD. It is an ancient wound. It always occurs, but the modern conditions make it far, far more more dangerous and destructive than ever before in history. The extent of our weaponry, its incredible degree of destructiveness, the speed at which it operates, the fact that we turn our weapons against civilian populations in the earth, and most casualties now are not armed combatants who are fighting more or less of an equal fight, but rather, as we just said, innocent civilians and the infrastructure and the earth itself. All of these conditions make war so stressful and deadly and dangerous and morally abhorrent that it's impossible to go through the war experience and come out unchanged. In fact, the only type of personality that can go through a war and come out the same as they went in is a psychopathic or a sociopathic personality, because that's what the combat environment is like. No conscience, instinctual release and gratification, no thought, no rationality, just explosive release. And so, sadly, we don't realize how very dangerous and destructive war is. We still mythologize it as if it were something that can be endured and that does make men and women. And neither the public nor service people know the horrible fields of hell they're being propelled into until it's too late.
Did you go through the service yourself?
No. I'm 56. I grew up during the Vietnam War era. I was in college protesting the war during its height. And then I always felt quite sympathetic and concerned about our service people. And during the Vietnam years, some people demonized the soldiers. I didn't. I just wanted them to come home. I was caught in my own moral dilemma, feeling like with my father, the World War II generation, and the belief we all grew up with that if our country is at war, we have to serve. I too had that belief. I wanted to be of service, but the war was so morally abhorrent that I couldn't serve it. And so I was preparing my conscientious objector plea and thinking if I had to go, maybe I could go as a medic and serve healing and still be of service. And then I got a high lottery number and never had to make a choice back during the Vietnam War. But I do believe that all of us need some form of service and certainly rites of passage and initiation to become full adult citizens, and felt something incomplete in myself from not serving and actually ultimately being safe from that war. Mm-hmm. And I moved to a rural part of central New York State in 1975. Turns out, of course, like in many of our rural enclaves, there were very many Vietnam veterans there, some from the rural areas because rural populations tend to gravitate toward our military more than many others.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to do. There are no other jobs, and small farms are going under, so military is sometimes the only way out. So there were many Vietnam vets who would return to this rural area, and also there were many who had fled New York City and other northeast cities for looking for more peace and tranquility in the countryside, and I met and worked with many of them as well. So by the late 70s, I was a beginning psychotherapist. I was meeting many veterans. They were asking for help and coming into my practice. And ironically, I didn't know and didn't consciously look for forms of service with Vietnam vets and to our generation, but that's what happened. I received a different kind of call to service and a different kind of draft notice. It was after the war and as a peacetime healer, but nonetheless, it became my form of devoted service to our generation in our country and causes of healing and peace.
One thing I would excuse me, like to do in the show, I'd like for you to talk about, let the listeners know, what is real, what happens to these soldiers when they first go in, how they get conditioned, what happens to them, what the traditional therapy was, what your therapy is, and how it's different and why it's a better way. Because I think a lot of us don't realize what all's involved. I didn't until I read your book, and I was shocked.
Okay. Well, thank you for the string of important questions and points.
It's a wake-up call for me, really.
I'll try to summarize all of that as best as I can, and please help me fill in the blank, because it's a big story, of course, and you're right to point out that the public only knows a small part of it.
I sure had no idea.
Yeah.
And it changes our boys' minds so much. I just was shocked at what went on in that boot camp training, especially the story you told about the kittens. I had no idea that something like that happened.
Well, for our listeners who haven't read it yet, our point is that boot camp is, well, in In descriptive and neutral terms, it's a house of initiation. We take our young civilian men and women, and now women are equally, as we know, vulnerable to serving in combat and go through profound transformation as well. So we take our young people who are civilians, who have been socialized to be cooperative and peace-loving and law-abiding ordinary citizens, and we have to actually, to create a soldier or a marine or sailor, we have to deconstruct the civilian identity and overcome all of the civilizing inhibitions that society has been teaching people for their whole life. It's most people really don't want to kill, and under ordinary conditions can't, but we actually have to create trained killers who are ready and able to respond to threat and to orders to kill and destroy without any hesitation and without a second's thought about it. And that's not an easy process. So boot camp is actually quite demanding and brutal, and everything from the beginning of having your head shaved and being called by a number or derogatory words, being forced in, you know, into uniform and forced into a very demanding daily physical regimen, that all serves to wear down the civilian identity that has been carefully constructed for 18 or more years, and instead substituted with a different kind of consciousness that can behave under military conditions, and even more can behave under combat conditions.
Sounded like
we have systematically in this country, we have systematically made boot camp more and more demanding and intimidating, so that the transformation to somebody who can kill has been increasing over the last decades. So during World War II, for example, only about 50% of the infantrymen were actually willing and able to kill and would fire their rifles directly at enemy soldiers. But by Vietnam, largely because of our training practices, guides have learned to brutalize the psyche even more to take down the inhibitions. So by Vietnam, the willingness to kill was up to about 90% among infantry combat troops. And now in Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the willingness to kill is almost to 100%.
What is it they do to them?
They practice severe intimidation, brutalization, extremely demanding and rigorous physical training that wears them down and wears any old civilian resistance down, and often also teach them to dehumanize the people against whom we're going to go into combat. So, for example, I've recently observed bayonet training of new recruits in my region, and the drill sergeants were taking these rather fresh young men who you could see that they didn't quite know what they were doing, and they still had inhibitions, and the drill sergeants would scream in their face, call them derogatory names, curse them, intimidate them, make fun of them for being like women, and with all kinds of insulting terms attached to it, and scream at them to dehumanize the other person, the enemy. And so I heard our drill sergeants screaming in the faces of our young recruits, "They're not human beings. They're towel heads and hajis, and you've got to tear their guts out." And then they would mime either killing our boys to scare them or show them how to kill an imagined enemy combatant while screaming and cursing and dehumanizing them and teaching them that they were subhuman. And so this is some of the type of training that goes on. Of course, it's not the only training, and I also don't want to trash the military, and I greatly honor our service people, and they are also practicing and trying to live by wonderful values of service and sacrifice and preserving and protecting the things they love best about, well, our homeland and our families and our ideals. And those are values are also instilled by the military. So there's this terrible conflict between how loving and patriotic many of our service people want to be and intend to be, the values of service and sacrifice and giving to the group and putting aside individual needs, that but we need more of those values in our society. And on the other hand, the terrible degree of death and destruction that we ask our service people to participate in, and how we have to traumatize our own people in order to make them agents of destruction.
It just is amazing. What does it do to their mind? I mean, how can they, once they do that first killing, how does it affect them when they turn around and walk away?
Well, it's the first kill is most combat troops report that is the very hardest one. And I've worked with many, many men and now some women who have had to relive their first killing over and over again. It really sticks in their minds. With the act of killing, they know they've crossed a threshold that changes them forever. We are meant to be life givers, life preservers. And so combat actually is proving to be especially traumatic for women, because women, of course, are the life creators and the life givers. And when women have experienced killing, it's an utter transformation of their identity, their whole sense of womanhood, and their purpose on earth that is extremely traumatic. So it's true for everyone that the first killing is very difficult, but perhaps even more painful for women. To realize that you can kill and to know how to do it makes you a different person, a different creature, gives you a different identity entirely in who you are and how you walk on the planet and how you take your place in society, because you know you can break all the rules in a split second, and you've been separated out. You've also been given divine powers. You have power over life and death in ways that civilians don't. And so, again, it puts you in a different class. And unless you have, as many warrior traditions did in the past, unless you have very, very strong spiritual and moral values that can enable you to carry this knowledge of how to kill and of how fragile life is, and that the power to take life has been put in your hands, you have to have enormous strength and spiritual and moral wisdom and depth in order to carry that without it doing harm.
How does it affect their ability to love afterwards? And be loved.
Intimate relationships become very, very difficult for combat veterans. After the Vietnam War, the separation and divorce rate was about 65% during the first year of combat veterans returning home from Vietnam. It's still the divorce rates among among military troops in general are high. Among people with PTSD are much higher, and combat veterans' divorce rates are very high. Domestic violence is high, criminality is high, suicide and homicide charges are very high. So some people, while PTSD is characterized as a stress and anxiety disorder, and I say that's not right, and it's other things as well, and better understood as an identity disorder and soul wound. Some people add attachment disorder to the list because post-traumatic stress disorder resulting from military and combat participation really causes profound disturbances in the way people love, their abilities to love, the ways they participate in family and general in close human relationships, and changes their sexuality as well. So many combat survivors become sexually, what we civilians would consider promiscuous, very, very sexually active, trying to look for human contact and intensity and passion to compensate for the pain and alienation they feel inside. Relationships are very hard often because people are prone to rages, impatience, difficulty with attention. The combat veterans tend to feel nobody on the planet but other combat veterans can really understand them, and so they lock up their stories inside. Civilians tend to be frightened of their stories, and so give them the message to keep it locked up inside. And these stories and feelings are so difficult that it's impossible to carry them alone. So when we lock war in people's heads, it drives them crazy.
That just tears me up thinking about it. So how do traditional psychotherapists deal with that, and how is that different from the way you think they should be dealt with?
Well, again, PTSD is classified as a stress and anxiety disorder. And the traditional treatment of it, there are several forms that are more popular. One thing is that, of course, medical doctors and psychiatrists often see people with PTSD, and they do use medications to a very significant degree. Many of the PTSD symptoms, depression, anxiety, panic, tendency to rage, sleep disorders, nightmares, the symptoms are often medicated so that a person with PTSD may be on 4, 5, 6 medications all at the same time for different symptoms, and also then some more medications to counteract some negative effects of the others. So I've had veterans walk in my office with huge computer printouts of their medication history, and they're like walking laboratories. Medications can certainly help reduce or ameliorate some of the symptoms when they're very severe and perhaps when they're life-threatening, but medications don't heal anything. And a person stays dependent on the medication in order to try to suppress the symptom, and then it can be even more difficult to do the therapy. We want medications, if we ever resort to them, to make a person more amenable to the therapy. But if they can't get to their memories and they can't remember their dreams and they've been up all night and they can't access their feelings, then you can't do the healing work.
Mm-hmm.
So medications are one popular response, but inadequate. Other responses are, since it's classified as a stress and anxiety disorder, many programs try to teach stress reduction techniques and to avoid the triggers that can set off traumatic stress reaction. So often people are counseled to stay in the present moment. Cognitive behavioral therapy modality is very popular, where we're training people how to think about their PTSD and to try to train their minds to stay in the present, focus on the here and now, think positively, and avoid anything that stresses them. Sometimes this helps people adapt and live more ordinary and civilian-type lives. The problems with that is that, again, people aren't emptying and healing the deep, deep inner wounds they're carrying from their war experiences. Often during this type of therapy, people are not even allowed to talk about their traumatic events. So I've had lots of veterans in therapy who have reported that with previous therapists, either in individual or group basis, though they in some cases were in therapy for years and years, and even in residential treatment programs for post-traumatic stress disorder, they were never allowed to talk about their combat experiences. One veteran was in a Veterans Administration hospital therapy group for in my region for 18 years and was not allowed to talk about his war experiences once in 18 years. Another woman I worked with who was a combat nurse was in a three-month residential program for PTSD, and it helped her a lot in terms of learning to live in the present and stabilize. But again, in 3 months, the program left one single afternoon for sharing and processing their entire war history. And can't be done. We really, in contrast to this, we need deep, long-term caring for our service people that encourages storytelling, allows and supports deep emotional expression, gives people guidance to transform their identities from disabled veteran or alienated soldier who can't speak with the public to a person who can learn to tell stories, achieve inner purification and catharsis, find meaning for in their service and in everything they experienced, give witness to the public, reintegrate with the culture and the society, and really form a new identity out of the war experiences that includes them.
What is the service person, well, the, I don't know what you call it, the management, I guess, of the services organizations do to help them while they're in there? Do they recognize it? Does that make sense?
Is the question is when people are either still in the military or in the Veterans Administration
right,
hospitals, is PTSD
military,
being...
Does the military recognize what's going on with them,
okay,
then, or do they just blow it off?
Actually, both are going on. There's a lot of blow-off and minimizing of PTSD. The public and the media have given enough attention to PTSD in recent times so that the military is trying to become accountable. The present statistics reported over the last couple of years are, well, New England Journal of Medicine had the first breakthrough empirical study saying about 30% of the troops were coming back, and that came out 2 years ago. And now even Veterans Administration and Department of Defense statistics are saying about 35% of the troops are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And we know the numbers are always higher than what's being reported. Troops in the field are given access to some mental health officers now. This is different and new. There's some attempt to prevent or reduce PTSD right in the field. So there are some chaplains and medical officers and mental health officers with our troops, but far too few. They are given surveys and checklists and can report PTSD if a soldier expects he or she has it. However, sometimes troops have been punished and kept in the combat zone if they report PTSD rather than sent home. Their deployment has been lengthened. Sometimes people have been punished by negative medical reports going on their permanent service records, and it's hurt their hopes for career advancement within the military. Sometimes people's release from the military has been delayed if they report PTSD. And the truth is, when after you've been in the war zone, if your release time is coming up, you want to get out as quickly as possible. And many troops, after what they've been through in the war zone, don't trust the military and don't want anything negative on their records. Right now, if a veteran, a newly released veteran, doesn't report PTSD within 2 years, then his right to apply for it disappears. And we know that it often doesn't surface until many years, sometimes decades after participation in combat. So 2 years is a very, very short time. And again, it artificially keeps the numbers down.
So what can we do about that?
About PTSD or about the underreporting?
About the underreporting and how they treat these people.
Well, the public really needs to be aware of the difficult, negative, and inadequate treatment. I have a not-for-profit organization called Soldier's Heart, and I've been going all over the country for the last 2 years, speaking in different communities and working with communities to learn what individual and groups of citizens can do to help our returning service people. Because the truth is that, unfortunately, our government does not have the resources or the know-how or perhaps even the will to give our returning service people all that they need. In addition, in our culture, there's an artificial division, an alienation between the citizen class and the warrior class. Many other cultures have much closer, more involved relations between citizens and their warriors. And in traditional cultures, the two classes were very close. One of the things I do to help our veterans heal is lead reconciliation and healing journeys back to Vietnam every year. I just came back about 10 days ago from my seventh trip back to Vietnam. And we have very much to learn from that culture, but keeping it focused on PTSD, it's shocking for Americans to learn that there is actually, though there was so much death and destruction in Vietnam, far more, of course, than we experienced. We had 58,000 killed. The Vietnamese had 3 million killed. We had 300,000 wounded. The Vietnamese had almost 5 million wounded. Their land and infrastructure were destroyed, and, of course, ours were not touched. So psychology, Western psychology would indicate that with that much death and destruction, the Vietnamese would be suffering severe post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. and it would be rampant in their culture. But, in fact, there's very little PTSD there.
Why is that?
And some of the reason is what we're talking about, that the culture itself takes responsibility for all of its veterans. The Vietnamese say there's no difference between veterans and civilians. We were all at war. Our entire country was under attack. We're one people. We never broke faith with our veterans, and we feel responsible to tend them and heal them and support them after the war. So they don't have the social alienation or mistrust that we have between veterans and civilians. In addition to that, it's a Buddhist culture, and Buddhism is based on living in the present moment, believing in the laws of karma, that what we do to others will affect the way who we are and the way our lives evolve, and that we, whatever happens, we've met our proper destiny and we're challenged spiritually to accept and affirm our destiny no matter how much suffering it causes us. So the Vietnamese deeply accepted the war, that it was necessary for them. They never thought of themselves as fighting Americans, but rather just fighting the most recent invader. And we were the last of, in a history of 1,200 years of invasions and occupations. But they always liked and respected Americans and never dehumanized us, even while they were fighting us. Ho Chi Minh even preached that during the war. Don't hate the Americans. The American GIs are victims of the war every bit as much as we are. So we have to fight them and repel them from our land, but we must not give in to personal hatred. So they had many, many spiritual and cultural practices that protect them from PTSD that we could learn from. And it really is our citizens' responsibility to find every way possible to reach out to our veterans, to create community-based programs that welcome them home and demonstrate that we will carry the burden and the pain of war with them rather than isolated in their hearts and minds.
I'm curious, would things like EFT therapy benefit those kind of disorders? You know, that it's a new therapy called emotional freedom technique where you do tapping on meridians to help.
Uh-huh. That therapy and other recent techniques like rapid eye movement therapy has been used somewhat effectively with PTSD and trauma survivors. The problem is there are some clinical issues that make it helpful, but sometimes not enough, because these therapies are oriented toward reprogramming us back in constructive and positive ways that we had before trauma. And that's a good goal, and some such reprogramming can sometimes be achieved. At the same time, veterans and other war survivors have been through the most awful and intensive dehumanization. And it occurred to overwhelming degrees. It's not the same as surviving a car accident or a mugging or a rape attack, because it happened multiple times, you know, sometimes every day. A person who had been deployed in the combat zone, well, the average in Vietnam was, if you were deployed for a year as a combatant, you had over 200 combat experiences. And also, our soldiers learned to kill and often did kill. So surviving combat trauma is far more severe than surviving even the most upsetting civilian traumas. And our veterans are used to being treated in terribly automatic and impersonal ways and really need healing relationships that are based on profound trust and inclusion, and somebody accompanying them slowly and carefully through all the hell that they carry in themselves. And many of these, the kinds of therapies we're talking about, counsel that we don't need to talk about the old traumatic events, and they can be discharged safely without them ever coming out in a relationship in detail. And I don't think that's right. And in my experience with veterans, the most important thing is to enter into a very deep brotherhood or sisterhood that's as tight as anything is that they experienced in the war zone with their battle buddies, and that profound amounts of love and attention and patience and spiritual wisdom and strength are necessary for the possibility of full healing.
So what would you suggest that maybe a wife of a returning soldier could do to help him?
Oh, that's very important, because well, there was a book on another subject in the psychology field. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a book about autistic children quite a while ago. The title was Love is Not Enough, and that pops into mind as my first piece of advice to wives of returning veterans, or husbands, because sometimes husbands stay home now and wives come back. It's really important that spouses of veterans realize that love is not enough, and that coming back to the civilian sector and even to supportive, loving families is not going to be enough to counteract the post-traumatic stress disorder, the impact of war. Love is necessary, and extraordinary amounts of patience and understanding are necessary, but it's really difficult to come back and readjust to civilian life. And in fact, as we said earlier, a veteran is changed forever, and the change has to continue, so that a husband and wife have to go through a profound degree of getting to know each other again, getting reacquainted. Spouses need and deserve therapy for themselves or support groups with other spouses, and a lot of education and training about what PTSD is and what it's like to live with it and need help in developing good strategies for how to live with it. So the wife and children will be profoundly affected also. One thing I always tell families of veterans and other survivors, if one person in the family has PTSD, the home life can become so emotionally explosive and rocky and unpredictable that everybody in the family will get PTSD. If one person, for example, wakes up many nights screaming with nightmares and maybe, you know, beating the air or punching or threatening or feeling that he's being attacked, that's going to be very disturbing and maybe even physically threatening to the spouse sitting next to you and very disturbing to the children who are going to be awakened by it. And everybody's life is going to be to develop PTSD symptoms. So we need to give our families enormous amounts of support and guidance and training about how to live with it. Sometimes it is right, for example, to approach a person who's in a rage slowly and carefully and try to encourage talking, but sometimes it's right to leave them alone and let them cool off by themselves, and sometimes it's necessary to get another veteran friend to come and talk because a vet may be the only one who can understand what the person's going through.
Do most of the soldiers recognize what it is that they have, or is it like not being able to see the forest for the trees?
No, you're right. It's the latter, unfortunately. It's usually not being able to see the forest for the trees. It usually takes a lot of difficulty and even what we would consider failure back in the civilian zone before a veteran can say, oh, I see, I can't or don't even want to fit in anymore. So it often takes, sadly, a whole string of failed relationships, breakups and divorces, an explosion of domestic violence perhaps, ongoing substance abuse, difficulty holding jobs, constantly changing jobs and maybe even changing where you live. All of these kinds of signs of ongoing instability and inability to re-enter civilian life is very common, and it often takes that. With new returnees from Iraq and Afghanistan, most of the calls for help I've been getting over the last several years have been from family members, parents and spouses, sometimes siblings, sometimes friends, occasionally children, of veterans who see the changes their loved one has gone through and are feeling concerned about their returned veteran and confused and desperate about how to help them. So it's very often the people who love us the most who see our changes for the worse and try to call them to our attention and try to get some professional help.
Do you have any success stories?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up before we still have time. I have a lot of success stories. The picture is so severe that conversations like ours this hour tend to sound very bleak. But I'm not bleak or despondent about PTSD or our ability to heal it. I have a lot of success stories, and I want to urge anybody listening to us to understand that post-traumatic stress disorder can heal. Our veterans can become very, even people who have had severe PTSD can become really joyous and well-adjusted and transformed human beings. And again, I'm gonna use the example of Vietnam because we can see some radical changes there. I've brought veterans back to Vietnam who, you know, served, 33, 35, even 40 years ago in that war. And some of them have had post-traumatic stress disorder for that long, for say 35 years. And when we go back to Vietnam, because the Vietnamese are so welcoming and forgiving, and they don't blame our troops but see them as we said earlier, as victims of war as well, and we're able to do so much by returning to the place of combat that we can't do in an office stateside. We go to places people fought, they grieve their dead, they remember those first kills or maybe many kills. We go to the graves of Vietnamese fallen. We meet their families and exchange reconciliation and forgiveness. I conduct veterans reconciliation groups between American veterans and Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army veterans. People learn by going back that there's nothing to be afraid of, and any expectation of punishment was going on in their own minds, and it's not that there's somebody out there waiting to get them. We also practice restoration projects, so people give back some of what they took, and they become agents of life and creation and renewal. So, for example, this trip, two of our veterans had been helicopter crew who killed water buffaloes, and so the two vets each bought a water buffalo and presented it to impoverished Vietnamese families. So they gave back what they took. We're reversing the meaning of an eye for an eye. Instead of taking revenge, it can mean giving back what I took from you.
I would imagine
If I can just finish this statement, because all the vets who go back in this way come back significantly healed. Some of them would look like complete healings, where they don't have any more nightmares, and they've gone from moody, grumpy, mistrustful people to joyous, engaged, lively, life-affirming people who then go to talk with other veterans and reconcile with their spouses and perhaps their alienated children, and take up healing from their PTSD as their own moral and spiritual journey. And it's not necessary to go to Vietnam to do that. I'm using that as an example of how much can be done in a short period of time. When we hear the pain that people are feeling who have PTSD and respond to it directly, we can create those kinds of strategies, and I do, stateside. You don't have to go to Vietnam. We can't go back to Iraq right now for people's healing, but we can take up the same big moral and spiritual and communal questions about what do I need to help restore life? What kind of grieving of our dead and of the others' dead do we have to do? How can I rehumanize the enemy? How can I give back to life and create a new and positive identity out of what I did? And that's very possible to do. And as we do that, PTSD really does lift. And people don't have to stay locked in that frozen and tortured war consciousness. They can come out of it. They can transform. They can come home.
So that can happen in just a short period of time if they face it that way?
Scouts honor. I've taken veterans back to Vietnam who have achieved extraordinary healing in just our 2.5 weeks over there, where they've healed things that they haven't been able to in decades at home. It sounds unbelievable, but it's true. And the third part of my book, War in the Soul, is full of these kinds of healing stories and healing strategies.
Well, and tell everybody, because we're getting close to the end, where they can find you in case they wanted to get involved in your treatment program.
Well, thank you. Am I allowed to say websites or
whatever
phone numbers?
Whatever you want to say, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I live in Albany, New York. My headquarters for my organization, Soldier's Heart, is in Troy, New York. The phone number for it is 518-274-0501. Have a website. That's www.soldiersheart.net. And I am working with communities all over the country. So we have regional contacts all over the country and some community programs, including in Atlanta, in your area.
And what is it called in the various...
Well, a new group in it just started in Atlanta that's called Soldier's Heart Atlanta, where a group of veterans and artists and writers and therapists and veterans' family members are getting together to create veteran safe return programming in your community for returnees and support systems for the families.
That's wonderful. So the families can go to and get help?
Yes. Families of veterans who are having a hard time, and also families... And also families of active duty service people, because they're also a neglected group that we really should be conscious of their suffering. Spouses who are surviving alone while they have spouses in the combat zone, and their children are all going under severe stress, and they need and deserve a lot of support.
How much does this cost?
I can give the my contact person in the Atlanta area is Robert Cagle, Bob Cagle. He is a Vietnam veteran. He's been back to Vietnam with me twice. He's a person anybody could talk to in your region, because he is one of the people we're talking about who has done enormous healing and has gone from really being plagued by PTSD to being a wonderfully healed, joyous, solid community member who's doing extraordinary healing work for other veterans and their families. And his phone number is 770-972-8598.
Okay. Now, and how does this cost? Does insurance pay for it, or is it...
No, we are... What we're doing is... well, if a person sees a therapist, it might be covered by insurance, but we're working to put together non-governmental, community-based support programming in communities all around the country. So we're looking for donations and raising funds as a nonprofit organization, and a lot of therapists are reducing their fees or giving some free counseling for veterans without resources.
Mm-hmm.
This is really trying to heal the citizen-warrior split that's in our country, that our veterans sacrifice so much, no matter what we think or feel about the war politically. Our veterans are not to blame, and they put their lives on the line and sacrifice so much for the rest of us. They need to feel us welcoming them home and having community support in place and being willing to sacrifice in response to what they suffered.
Now, is this a group that they can go to as well as individual help?
We're working on that. It varies all over the country. So we have an extensive program in Seattle and in my region in the Capital District of New York State, where we have groups. We have I run workshops and retreats all over the country, and they were quarterly this year. We're trying to have healing workshops in different parts of the country almost every month during the coming year, and so people can travel for 3 or 4 or 5 day intensive healing retreats for their PTSD, and many people are choosing this as their main therapeutic modality and going to our intensives regularly every couple of months.
I'm so glad somebody's doing this work. I had no idea it was so bad.
Thank you.
I really did. So tell us, we've got about a minute left. Tell us one more time where people can find you before we end.
Okay. Again, my organization is called Soldier's Heart. My website is www.soldiersheart.net. My phone number is 518-274-0501. Email is simply info@soldiersheart.net. And people, both active duty people, therapists, healers, clergy, family members, veterans, are all finding my book, War in the Soul, very, very helpful in understanding it, the inner world of combat veterans, and giving them a roadmap for how to come home.
Where do you get this book?
Most of the larger bookstores have it. It's published by Quest Books, and you can get it online or call Quest Books or order it from any bookstore.
Thank you, Dr. Tick, for coming on.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your attention to this important topic.
Absolutely. Maybe you can come back sometime.
I'd be honored to. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. And good
night.
You're
welcome. Good night.